Now you masters of war. You that build all of the guns. You that build the dead plains. You that build the big bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind the desk. Just want you to know that I see through your mask. That never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. Put a gun in my hand. Hide from my eyes and turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly.
50 years ago, in the fall of 1964, students at the University of California, Berkeley, embarked on what would become one of the epic battles of the 60s, the battle for free speech at the university campus. In the end, the students won. They'd won the right to be politically active on and off campus, and their victory helped arouse and shape the great student revolt of the decade to come. At Berkeley, student politics was transformed. This new, energized, confident generation would have no time to rest, however. This is the second in a series of programs that will air every Friday morning in November at 9 a.m. here on KZYX. We're going to remember and celebrate these events in a special series on the free speech movement. I'm Cal Winslow. I'll be your host. This morning, we'll talk with two people, Barbara Garson, writer and playwright. Her latest is Up the Down Escalator. She also wrote the enormously popular play in 1966, McBird. Frank Bardicky is the author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, A History of California Farm Workers. In 1968, he was one of the Berkeley-based Oakland Seven, an indicted leader of the Stop the Draft Week. But first, we'll listen to Paul Potter of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, addressing the 1965 teach-in at the Berkeley campus.
Most of us grew up thinking that the United States was a great and humble nation that only involved itself in the affairs of other countries reluctantly and as a last and final resort. But now the war in Vietnam has provided the incredibly sharp razor that has finally separated thousands and thousands of people from their illusions about the morality and integrity of this country's purposes internationally. Never again will the self-righteous, saccharine moralism of promising $1 billion of economic aid while we spend billions and billions of dollars to destroy them. Never again will that moralism have the power to persuade people of the essential decency of this country's aims. What kind of a system is it that allows decent men, good men, to make the decisions that have led to the thousands and thousands of deaths that have happened in Vietnam? What kind of a system is it that justifies the United States in seizing the destinies of other people and using them callously for our own ends? We must name that system, and we must change it and control it, else it will destroy us.
And our next guest then is Barbara Garson, the writer and playwright, and Barbara was an active student in the fall of 1964 at Berkeley. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Barbara, could you just maybe, you know, try to tell us a little bit about your own experience, especially as a student, and then maybe, you know, what happened afterwards? But what was it like being a student living through through this movement in that fall 50 years ago?
Well, I remember it as fun. I am very surprised when I went back to the reunion to see how many people were very frightened. What would happen to them if they got arrested? What would happen to them in Sproul Hall? Would they be beaten up? I don't know. I was just oblivious to all that. I just was just going through the course of the FSM. It was exciting. It was fun. And I have to say that there wasn't, the spirit was wonderful. And you could have to make a decision. Do we sit in now? Do we go home? Do we come back? Do we just sit in for a day? You could make a decision about three or four options that were presented to a crowd of 5,000 people. And you felt that the steering committee had picked people who could present those four or five options. And you didn't feel like you had to speak. And we had the same egotistic guys around us that, you know, that the women's movement rebelled against, if you want to say that. But just somehow it was really, you had to decide what to do, and you just concentrated on what was right. There was just a good feeling. There wasn't a competition to be the student leader, because there wasn't such a thing as a student leader. There wasn't any knowledge that this was an important, this was something you could be important. It just fell together with harmony. I know that sounds corny. It was harmonious. And even though this was before the women's issue, it was not marked by that kind of stuff that was on the fringe of the civil rights movement, of touchy relations between men and women and put downs and stuff. It was nice. We were good kids, and it was a democratic and nice movement. And of course, we won.
And you say kids, Barbara. Were you an undergraduate?
You know, yes. And I would say kids now, only because I went back and looked at the pictures. I was a person. I didn't think of myself as a kid. I was married, for one thing. I was on my own economically. That's why I was out on the West Coast, because school was free. And I didn't feel like a kid then, but I go back and look at the pictures and see how well dressed we were, how sweet we were. I'm amazed.
And were you political to begin with when you got involved?
Yes, I didn't grow up in a political family, but I had gone to Cuba for a honeymoon, so when I came back, so, you know, black was white. I mean, I couldn't believe what stories were being told after what I saw. And so I became involved with, you know, socialists and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. So, yes, by the time the FSM hit, I was what you would call a politico, although I never was in any of the, you know, adult socialist parties.
Mm-hmm. And When the sort of movement came, I guess it was kind of a culmination, and the sit-in took place, did you have any issues, problems doing that, being involved?
Well, no. It seemed so obvious. I people have told me since then, my daughter tells me I'm oblivious crossing the street. My husband says I'm oblivious to policemen trying to stop me for things when I'm, you know, like I duck under the subway if I'm in a hurry. And then I just go on like it was my... And so people tell me I'm oblivious, but I never... We just went in with Joan Baez singing, and we waited for the police to come, and I don't think I worried about being arrested or what that might mean, or... No, I don't. I don't think I did. Or being hit or what that might mean, or being dragged down the stairs. I see it now in the films, but I... No, we just went along, and maybe I'm a sheep, but no, I didn't have that kind of worry. I think there was a period where I was worried about getting my schoolwork done, and then I gave up on it.
And were you involved in one of the campus groups, like CORE, or one of those that was involved?
Yes, I was in Campus CORE, and I was also the editor of the Free Speech Movement newsletter. And I have always been embarrassed to look back because I figured, oh, we were so dumb then. But I just looked back at the newsletters. These newsletters were not the daily bulletins by which we communicated with each other on campus. What do we do next? This is what the school said. This is what we said. This is, you know, these were issued periodically, especially to keep the other campuses informed. And I look back and, boy, were we smart. The writing was so good. Boy, did I cut to the chase. I wish I could write that way now. No, you know.
Well, yeah, I think
the five newsletters that Robbie Cohen has saved for us, I'm just amazed. They were wonderfully, wonderfully written. And they were lively. That's what I was doing a lot of the time, putting together the newsletter and going to all the rallies and trying to, you know, for instance, let's say we had to let everybody on campus know that there would be a strike the next day or that there would not be a strike the next day. We had a chain phone call. We didn't have email in those days. And we had, you know, maybe 10, 15,000 people to call. And you'd start the calls at 10 o'clock at night. Why? Because there's no sense making calls at 6 and 7 and 8 when people will be out. And you started the call at 10 o'clock at night, and you call five people, and the next people would call five people, and you distribute the names. And if you reach people at 2 o'clock in the morning, they didn't say, what the hell? This was part of the thing. They were part of the FSM, and, oh, that's the news, and then, I'll call my five people. I never since then have been part of something where the whole community was mobilized. If you went down on Telegraph Avenue, you had carried things to reproduce the newsletters, to print them off, then people would help you. People would drive up with cars. You're doing that for the FSM? They would drive you to the print shop. If somebody else was doing something, you know, people in normal stores would say, "Oh, that's for the FSM," and let the copying be done first. It was quite a. It was like. I guess it's like what Wordsworth said about the French Revolution, you know, to be alive.
Bliss to be alive.
Bliss at that dawn to be alive, yeah. But to be young was very heaven.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kept me going for a long, long time.
So, but there was a serious
Since
side
then.
To it. You're saying
that. I didn't say it wasn't serious.
No. I'm saying, but there were.
But that there wasn't a lot of infighting. That's the stuff that holds me back. That's the stuff that, when that happens, I tend to want to collapse and crawl away when it's infighting.
But there were consequences as well. I think you told me that you
went
to jail. And what was that like for a youngster like yourself?
I hate to say it, but that was fun too. I just got together again with my friend Anita Medill, with whom I was in jail. And, you know, we were in jail for a certain period while a certain legal question of our bail bonds were being tested. And we had 15 days, but once the million-dollar bail for trespassing was ruled legitimate, we could have gotten out on bail and waited and eventually paid a fine probably. Don't ask me what's wrong with me. We were so happy in jail that we said, let's get it over with now, like Martha Stewart. She was smart, too, that way. And so, and we were heroes in the jail because when 800 of us had been arrested at once, then the jail had come to a stop pretty much. No one's chores happened, no penalties happened. And so this was a short-term jail, and people remembered us when we came back as part of that group that had made their jail time a little better. But, I mean, the serious stuff happened. I'm not saying that we weren't working for the ability to have to espouse our civil rights causes and to help the farm workers and things like that and to have free speech on campus. But I was very young, lucky for that to have been my first political activity.
Here's something that you've written recently, I think, and I thought the listeners might like to hear it. This is you, Barbara Carson. After the most exhilarating, exhausting, and educational school year imaginable, all bans were lifted. That victory sent us out into the world confident that we could perfect the planet, or at least our own country. Could you say a word about that?
I think FSMers felt that way. The only thing that we weren't confident about, yes, I think we all got involved in other causes and other organizations, maybe essentially the same cause, and other organizations, quite confident that we could, none of us could believe the way it has wound up, with money so much in charge and ordinary people falling behind and under such financial and emotional pressures and stresses. It's shocking. So we were confident in every way, and the FSMers who came to the reunion were amazing at the activities they've participated in over the years. We weren't confident in one regard. We had no sense that we could maintain an organization without being corrupted. In other words, we literally dissolved the free speech movement. We took a vote. It said it's over. Because we didn't feel, largely because we didn't feel we could go on in a unified manner and that we wouldn't become co-opted and so on. That was wrong. That was cowardly. Yes, we probably would have been co-opted. Yes, we might not have won. But that we have not left behind an ongoing independent student union on different campuses or an independent newspaper, that the whole 60s, in fact, hasn't left behind a television station, a radio station, a daily newspaper, that we don't have an organization. This is a failure, and it's a failure of confidence, a failure that we could become ordinary and still keep our principles. I think that's why most people, if you went to participate in Occupy, which I did, you saw the same thing, that the reason people didn't want to adopt an anarchist philosophy of organization was that they didn't want to be like bad organizations. And so that's where we weren't confident. And I'm very sorry on this election day, that's when you and I are speaking, that we don't have an ongoing organization to counter the corrupt organizations that are well organized this day.
Okay. Back to the 60s.
That's a pleasure. What a good idea to go back.
You wrote, you became active in the anti-war movement, I think. Could you say a word for us about MacBird, your play?
Oh, well, yes, I wrote the play MacBird, and I started it for a teach-in on campus, and it was never performed at that teach-in.
So what was MacBird?
MacBird was a full-length play that was a form of Macbeth. I don't want to say a parody. Well, I just want to say a parody of Macbeth because I used as much real Shakespeare as I could and wrote as much like him as I could. So it was Macbeth. It was a form of Macbeth in which Johnson was Macbeth and Kennedy was Duncan, except that Johnson and Kennedy were the same politically. You had to listen to the play because Kennedy was saying all these beautiful things and Johnson wondered, like Richard III, why he looked so crude and with these princes pipe and, in cheerful tunes and look beautiful to everyone else. Johnson and Kennedy were the same in that play, and what they were actually saying was the same. And so I was really appealing to the people who had organized so much up to that point, not to go on to the Kennedy bandwagon or the Democratic Party bandwagon. Now, that was just a part of the play, and it fell in with the general action. And I must say, that didn't. I couldn't even get people to sign third-party petitions to get third parties on the ballot outside where the play was playing, so the play didn't have that force. It was just a very good, very funny play.
And then,
and it sold 500,000 copies as a book.
Yeah. And then the war. The
yeah,
war.
And I was much smarter than I was now. And also working with Shakespeare works.
And then the war became an issue on campus.
Now, you say that we switched to anti-war activity. I thought it was really terrible. Over the years, you know, every time you want to fight for socialism here or for a better society here, for a just society here and a pretty one, too. And every time you're going on something positive, and the FSM was certainly something positive about how we would run our daily lives and how we would be able to do something meaningful with our education, suddenly you're switched to the negative. Get out of this and get out of that and get out of the other thing. I mean, you know, you have a sort of a generic get out of sign, you pull it out of the closet and you march on Washington. It, to me, in a sense, anti-war work was a setback because it was anti. So I wound up working in a GI coffee house. That was the small coffee houses we set up near these army bases in these isolated towns where they were. And in those places, we were working for and with American GIs, who, as you know, themselves went on to do an awful lot to end the war.
And you say we, Barbara, you and other students?
We I don't know. Maybe a couple of hundred people worked on all the coffee staffs put together, and more people raised some money for it. Mm-hmm. Pretty badly funded. I mean, we didn't make our money selling coffee, and our secret weapon was much better coffee. Mine was not far from Seattle in Tacoma, Washington, so we used to go to Seattle and get the kinds of coffees that later became, by the way, that were much better than Starbucks because we didn't burn ours. So, yes, we had these coffee houses, and we served coffee to the GIs, and in them, they did the kinds of things they, you know, there were more than 150 different GI newspapers. That is to say, they could be short-lived based newspapers where, you know, maybe the nucleus that were putting them out might be broken up by the Army sending them to different places, but they would go on for a few issues or some of them much longer. And they were pretty good, too. Well, not as good as my newsletter, but they were good.
So
that was a way for me to work positively with young people. Well, I was a young person. Oh, I was an old person. I was like 25 at the time that I was working with 18 and 19-year-olds. But with people who I then met later who were part of part of the American working class and part of, in All the Live Long Day, I run into somebody I met at the coffee house when he's working at General Motors, and he's part of that group that's striking to slow down the assembly line. So, you know, I wanted to be part of that future, not just part of get out of. So the coffee house, I mean, definitely the anti-war movement was a setback, a step back. A necessary step back, perhaps, but a step back from reorganizing the country in some positive way.
So we've got a minute left here. Let's just conclude. 2 minutes. Let's just conclude then. I know you've thought about this a lot, and you've written about it. What came back to you when you came out here this? This fall and saw the other veterans and what looking at it from that direction.
Well, you couldn't help seeing how healthy and good looking the FSM veterans are. Maybe that's true of all the people that come to reunions. They're the ones that are pretty much satisfied with their weight and their spouses and their lives. But also to be on a campus where students have huge debts, where the school that was free to us leaves them with the burden that will last their whole lifetime. They're not just huge debts. They're the worst kinds of loans in the country. They're usurious. They have terrible. I mean, I couldn't believe the way this middle class, which you have to call people who are going to university, the genuine middle class, going to a university, a state university, And they are so, I mean, imagine if I tried to jump into the FSM now, heedless of my school term, heedless of future jobs, when I've got $100,000 in debt, a debt that cannot be dispersed in bankruptcy, a debt that can be taken out of my parents' income, a debt that can be taken out of Social Security if I ever live to it. What a different thing. What a different life these students are living. Only the foreign students are carefree now. Only the foreign students come around to see what's happening.
Right. Well, Barbara,
we failed them. We definitely failed them. I mean, we should have had an ongoing FSM student union.
Okay, Barbara.
Okay.
Yes and no, I think you also didn't fail us in many ways. But I've been talking.
Oh, gosh, you're not a young student.
I've been talking to Barbara Garson, the writer and playwright and free speech movement activist. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this morning, Cal Winslow. Thanks, Barbara, and I look forward to talking to you again. Our guest now is Frank Bardicke. Frank Bardicke was a student leader at the University of California, Berkeley in the 1960s, and he now lives in Watsonville, where he's a writer and an educator. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Just been talking to Barbara Garson, and one of the things she said was that in the aftermath of the FSM, the students, these are her words, went out into the world confident that we could perfect the planet or at least our own country. And yet, right then, along came the Vietnam War. I wondered if you could help us make the transition and maybe some connections between free speech movement and anti-war movement.
Well, I think that Barbara's right that people felt... as opposed to young people today, people felt very confident that that we could change the world to our satisfaction. It seems funny even to say it, but we did feel that that whatever was wrong, we were going to fix it. And the free speech movement had been such a victory that the fact that there was this war out there wasn't going to stop us, and we were going to try to end the war. So there was in the period, in the general period, there was a tremendous amount of optimism that I think is missing today. People are concerned about survival. People are worried about sort of just getting by. Nobody's really dreaming of making a better world. The biggest thing for people looking back, for people today, the biggest thing to understand about the anti-war movement, the Vietnam anti-war movement, is that the extent to which it was an anti-draft movement. That is the difference, like in terms of mounting a building an anti-war movement against the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan or any of the coming wars around the world, is that back in the day, there was not only were people against the war, young people against the war, but there was a very real danger that they were going to have to go serve in it. So this focused your attention. And the big part, I think, more so than we realized, the big part of the anti-war movement was that people were, people could be drafted and sent to Vietnam. In the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, even when the war in Iraq was at its height a few years ago, in the rest of the country, there was hardly even any sense that a war was going on. I mean, unless you were a military family, you didn't really have a sense that a war was going on. That was totally not the case in the Vietnam War. Everybody knew a war was going on because you could be sent, and also because it wasn't the same kind of media control that there is now, and the war was on the nightly news, and the nightly news was the way that most people got their news. So the whole country was at war, very different than the feeling in the country about Iraq and Afghanistan.
So if my memory's right, on the campus in Berkeley, there was the great teach-in of, was that 1965?
And then, yes, that was.
And then there was the Stop the Draft movement, and I think you were very much involved in that.
Yeah, I was involved in Stop the Draft Week. What this was, one of the things that I think also is lost is that the movement didn't spring out of nothing. I mean, there weren't 100,000 people walking in the streets of San Francisco overnight where there hadn't been anybody the week before. Starting in 64 and 65, there was a lot of basic educational work that was done about the war. People did research and looked into the history of the war, and then there were numbers of pamphlets and articles written, and a whole bunch of people would go and talk in the dorms. I remember we used to go in the dorms and at Berkeley and go into the cafeteria and stand on a chair and say, anybody who wants to come and talk about the war in Vietnam, come on after, we're going to meet in this little room afterwards. And we'd get 25 or 30 people because these were young men who were worried about the draft. And so there was a tremendous amount of just educational work that went on before there were the big marches. Then there were the big marches. There were the big marches in San Francisco. There were the big marches in New York in 66 and 67. And meanwhile, the war escalated. So the big marches seemed to have no effect whatsoever. There was also, at the time, there were very different times. There's the end of the civil rights movement and the beginnings of the Black Power movement. The whole world is in motion, and so a group of people, both on the East Coast and on the West Coast, our notion was, well, we can't just keep marching because it doesn't seem to be doing any good. We have to move from protest to resistance. Was the slogan, protest to resistance. So we declared. A group of us got together and we declared a draft holiday, that there wouldn't be anybody inducted at the Oakland Induction Center for an entire week. And we were just going to stop the inductions. We were going to stop the process. And because of all this other work that had been done, because the war was so much in the minds of young people And because the protests, the regular protests, had been going on for a couple of years to no effect, we in fact ended up with 10,000 people in front of the induction center, and it took the National Guard to clear us out of the way.
Where was that?
To bring in
Frank. Where was that?
That was in Oakland,
right?
1967. It was called Stop the Draft Week.
Hmm.
And we were there. Seven of us were indicted for conspiracy for planning it, and a conspiracy to commit a misdemeanor. Planning it was a misdemeanor, is a felony. So we were put on trial for we were up to 10 years in jail. And I don't mean to make this is just one small part of the whole thing that was happening. I don't, it just happened to be the part I was involved in, but I don't mean to make it any more important than it was. But we were put on trial, and we were stone guilty. I mean, we did plan to obstruct the police. We did plan to commit misdemeanors. We did plan to stand in the, not clear the streets, to stand in the way. We planned to try to shut the induction center down. So we were guilty. There was no doubt that we were guilty. But the judge allowed us to say why we did all that. And that allowed us to, in 1968, to give our argument against the war in Vietnam. And even though we were stone guilty, we were all acquitted. And we were acquitted because the jury became convinced that the war in Vietnam was wrong and that we were right, even though we were technically guilty. And that wasn't just because we were so articulate on the stand. That was because the society was moving against the war. And so at the end of 1968, after the Tet Offensive, in fact, the majority of the American people are against the war. And there's a decision by Johnson and the people around him to de-escalate the war and to basically negotiate a way out.
And the university, did they essentially give anti-war students a free hand in this?
There were a few times on campus that people were busted, but the university had been chastened, you know. The university had been defeated in the anti-war movement, and they knew not to do too much to try to interfere with anti-war work on campus. They weren't about to arrest too many more people on campus and face the wrath of a confident student body. So the university didn't really interfere that much. I mean, the anti-war movement around the war in Vietnam is one of the most successful anti-war movements in the history of humanity. I mean, the big we, did put limits on the United States' ability to wage the war in Vietnam. The victory really belongs in the hands of the Vietnamese people, but we helped.
Mm-hmm.
In the decision after the Tet Offensive, when the wise man came around Johnson, when they called in the representatives of the ruling class to advise Johnson on what he should do after the Tet Offensive, and the military suggested that there were already 550,000 troops in Vietnam, and the military suggested that we need 300,000 more. And the Air Force said, well, look, if we put 800,000 troops in there, we're not going to have enough airstrips in Asia to give for the planes to land that we need, given the amount of air cover we need for that number of troops. That was a consideration. But another consideration was J. Edgar Hoover came to those meetings and he said, look, if you want 300,000 more men, you're going to have to call up the National Guard. And if you call up the National Guard, I can't guarantee the security of the United States. So the anti-war movement was a consideration in Johnson's decision to de-escalate and to resign his office and to move into negotiations. And then Nixon came in and tried to win the war through air power. And apparently
he was dissuaded, I've heard, from using nuclear weapons in part because of opposition at home. Do you think that's right?
Yes, I think on nuclear weapons, I don't think opposition at home was as important as the fact that there were two nuclear powers that were supporting the Vietnamese. I think that they decided not to risk nuclear war over Vietnam.
Okay.
At some point.
Frank, several speakers have emphasized the impact of the civil rights movement on the students at Berkeley. But this movement, too, was transformed, above all, with the rise of black power. What was your take on this?
Well, it's certainly true that at the beginning of the 60s, two crucial things to young people were the early civil rights movement in the South. And the Cuban Revolution. People forget the Cuban Revolution
right.
in this. There's a kind of view that that the young people were like good young girls and boys who just wanted to bring black people out of discrimination and into the American dream, and that's all they really wanted in the early years, and later they become revolutionaries. That's kind of the Todd Gitlin view. It's very popular. It's nonsense, because most of the people I know who were early into politics in the early 1960s, we were certainly almost everybody had been to the South, and we were very involved in the civil rights movement. But almost everybody had been to Cuba too, and so we had revolutionary hopes from the very beginning. There were revolutionary hopes.
Mm-hmm.
So when the civil rights movement moves to the North, and becomes the Black Power movement, and leads to the substantial riots in the American cities. I was amongst the people, and not alone, but it looks foolish now, but it didn't seem foolish back then, who, you know, really, we really thought we were in a pre-revolutionary period. That, you know, what was the reason the Panthers, I mean, the Panthers had a lot of trouble. You can look back and find lots of things wrong with the Panthers. You can look back and find lots of things wrong with almost everything that human beings are a part of. But the big thing about the Panthers is that they were African-American socialists with guns. That was, that's what scared the establishment, and that's what was exciting to the rest of us. And so we thought that revolution was on the agenda, and that was a part of the reason that people went and worked in working class jobs, because people still believe the working class was the major sector that would lead to revolutionary change. I mean, it sounds kind of silly to use that kind of language now, but we really believed it. And, you know, and to a certain extent, it wasn't wrong in the sense that, you know, even though there's the legacies of the 60s, I think the hopes of the 60s were, you know, we were defeated. It was a defeat. It was a world historical defeat. I mean, and my understanding of it, of why we were defeated, is because the students as a social class, as a social grouping, simply aren't powerful enough by themselves to make fundamental changes in society. They just can't do it. They're just not a part of enough element of the society. So like in Japan, the student movement in Japan in 67 was so powerful that most of the major universities in Japan were shut down for an entire year. But meanwhile, the factories kept on working and the society kept on going. So students needed to make alliances with other people. And, of course, then, in our own personal histories, we were growing up. You know, well, okay, so, like, you grow up, you got to do something. and so you got to get a job, you know. And so then you start thinking about the sectors in which you work and where you're going to work and what place you might have the most impact. And so then, there, of course, there was also a way, as you well know, Cal, there was a upsurge of working class struggle in those very same years. There were more strikes than there had been since 1948 or 47, I forget which is that big year. And there were all these insurgent movements within the regular unions. And so a number of people went and what people called either industrializing themselves or proletarianizing themselves. People went and worked in the working class movement and worked inside insurgent movements inside unions. So all of that was happening too.
Barbara Garson was just talking to me, and she insisted that I ask you to say something about the farm workers, because she said she felt that right from the beginning of the period we've been talking about, that the farm workers and their struggles were central. Do you agree?
No.
No. So you don't think agribusiness got onto the university because of support for the farm workers?
I think that, I think the farm workers are important. I don't think they were crucial. I mean, I don't think they were at the center of it. I think, I think African Americans are the center of it.
Okay.
I just think that the African Americans, led the way. They led the way the civil rights movement. They led the way with it. They led the way sort of incorrectly in the notion that we were kind of in a pre-revolutionary period. But I think that people took their clues from what black people were doing, more from what farm workers were doing. The farm worker movement becomes really important in 66 and 67. That's the they come on the scene in 1966 with the March to Sacramento. And their appeal, what's happening in the society at that time, is it's the beginning of the black riots in the major U.S. cities, Los Angeles, Detroit, New York, Newark. And at the same time, at the very same time, it's Operation Thunder in Vietnam. Johnson has won the election, and he has very greatly escalated the war in Vietnam. So at what you're seeing on TV is sort of the American cities burning and young people burning the American flag and more violence and involvement in Vietnam. And there's a split between sort of liberals, maybe it's a generational split also, but people who stand by Johnson and are horrified by the riots, and are sort of nostalgic for the old civil rights movement, and young people who are opposed to the war, are not standing by Johnson, are opposed to the war, and don't feel the same way about the riots. They feel that the riots are a legitimate rebellion, and that split between liberals and radicals, between older, it's between Ruther and Hayden, if you will, if you want the names. That split is consequential on the American left, very consequential. Now, what the farm workers did, what they did was that they came forward and they said, look, we're nonviolent, and you can help us just by boycotting grapes, and if you boycott grapes, we'll be tremendously grateful. Their slogan was, boycott, baby, boycott. And it was a conscious slogan as opposed to burn, baby, burn. And because they were a working class movement, and because they were nonviolent, and because they allied originally with sort of the insurgent union movement, the support for the farm workers was the only place that the liberals and the radicals agreed. And so in the boycott committees around the nation, you would have both representatives from the older liberals who were supporting the war in Vietnam and the young radicals who were absolutely against it. You had support from people from the old civil rights movement who were horrified by the riots, the Northern riots, and you had people who supported the Northern riots. So the Black Panthers came to boycott meetings. The Black Panthers came to boycott meetings, and they would meet people from the officialdom of the UAW there, And that was the only place in American society that those two elements were talking to each other. And so that's kind of the role that I see that the farm worker movement played in the general society. And neither the liberals couldn't desert them because they were nonviolent, and the radicals couldn't desert them because they were working class and part of the insurgent union movement. Now, that's the role that the farm workers played in the general society. The role that the UFW played in the fields amongst farm workers is a whole different story, and one that we can't go into this afternoon.
So for the student movement, and you remained active through the 60s, I think, the student movement then went from free speech, it became an anti-war movement, and there were other issues on campus and in the East Bay communities that you were active in. How did this all progress?
Well, the anti-war movement, I think, was after the free speech movement in the Bay Area. I think the anti-war movement was the principal thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there were also terribly important other things. I mean, the women's movement was what they call second phase feminism. The women's movement was born in those years. And Berkeley played a very important role in the women's movement. And then there was also the beginnings of a sort of the ecological movement. So there was a struggle over People's Park, which became a kind of we're going to add the green flag to the flag of revolution, you know, to the red flag of revolution. So there was People's Park was an extremely powerful event, the struggle around People's Park, and you can argue that it was the beginning of some sort of ecological sense or a different attitude towards what cities are for, and sort of pointed to a certain degree to some kind of notion of sustainability and stuff like that. So the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the movement around People's Park, and the beginnings of ecological sensitivity, all of those things were important. Then also, at the time, it's very, I mean, if, I don't know, you know, who's listening to this, but maybe some people remember and some people don't, but there's just a feeling in those years of the whole world is in motion. The whole world, you know, there's riots in Mexico City and riots in Paris and riots in Japan and the Vietnamese beat the Americans. And it's just a sense of, I remember when I was a young man, I used to say, in that period, to people, and I wasn't that young, you know, I was in my late 20s, I used to say to people, you know, in 50 years, the only issue is going to really be what kind of socialist you are.
Okay.
You know, that's the only issue, you know. I mean, how wrong could I be? But that's the way, I wasn't the only one who felt that way. I mean, like, everybody felt that way.
All right. Well, Frank, it's been great talking to you. You filled in a lot for us, and I'll look forward to talking to you again. Thanks, Frank.
It was a pleasure, Cal. I hope it all wasn't too obscure.
Oh, no. We'll continue this discussion of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement and its aftermath here next week, and then for 2 weeks after that at 9 a.m. at KZYX Mendocino County Community Radio. This morning, we talked with two activists from the 60s, Barbara Garson, the writer, and Frank Bartike, the anti-war activist and community educator. Next week, we'll talk with Michael Watts about the divestment movement, which was to follow, and then with Wendy Brown, who will talk about the meaning or the meanings of free speech. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Thanks for listening, and good morning.
Your mind is in your way. No more tears, do we cry? just can you